Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Eddie Schumart, and you're listening to a special community session on heritageradionetwork.org. You can listen to this and other shows archived on heritageradionetwork.org as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Today's guest is Michael Moss, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, investigative reporter at New York Times, and author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the first thing that kind of strikes me about this book is the cover, and we're on radio, so nobody can see it right now, but each of those words, salt, sugar, and fat, are, you know, they're cutouts of popular brands, and to me, it reminded me of like a ransom letter. And you know, how much of writing this book and doing the research was it, you know, did you get a sense of like being a detective in the suspense story?
You hit it exactly. It was totally like being inside a detective story. Especially when I ran across a trove of internal confidential documents that, you know, basically put me and the reader at the table when senior executives of the largest food companies are planning, plotting, formulating their ways, you know, into our stomachs. And that in turn helped me convince really key people in the industry, scientists, marketers, to talk to me and reveal even more secrets.
Right. And, you know, you open the book with this really fascinating story of this secret meeting in 1999 among these top CEOs and these food giants. You know, it was, to me, it was sort of like an intervention, you know, it was, you know, and so did the industry go to rehab after this? Like, what was the outcome of this meeting?
They felt like it, believe me. I mean, there were two extraordinary things about it. One, that these CEOs of the largest food companies in North America would get together in the first place. I mean, normally they're just, you know, fighting each other fiercely for space on the grocery shelf and looking for ways to do one another in. They were called together and they agreed to meet to talk about none other than the emerging obesity crisis. And then the most amazing thing about them was that the person who got up in front of them, this is at the old Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis, was none other than one of their own, a senior executive of Kraft, at the time the largest food company. He was armed with 114 slides and the conviction that they were at least partly responsible for the obesity crisis. And he lays out the numbers and he lays out even connections of their foods to cancer, says, look, and he touches the third rail and compares food to tobacco and says, look, even if you're not convinced you're responsible, the lawyers who went after Big Tobacco are going to come after you. And then he pleads with them to collectively do the responsible thing and turn a corner on behalf of consumers. As you might imagine, the CEOs reacted defensively. They argued that they're already doing things to give consumers a choice. They offer, you know, better-for-you versions of their mainline products. And they felt that the concerns about obesity back then were exaggerated.
So, you know, after such a, you know, a defensive reaction to that, you know, a meeting, you know, why talk to you? Why did you get such an inside preview? You know, why did you get to pull the curtain back? Why tell the truth, so to speak, now?
You know, I think that fundamentally it was, you know, it was my attitude, which continues today, that, I mean, I don't see these food giants as being evil empires out to intentionally make us obese or otherwise ill. And nor do I point at any one of their products as being, you know, as being responsible for the obesity situation, epidemic, soda included, my favorite, potato chips included. Rather, these are companies doing what companies do, which is make lots of money by selling lots of product. And we also always knew that eating too many of these foods, I call it the foods, especially the foods that we hate to love, would make us, you know, could make us ill and overweight and otherwise sick. But what we now know is that the industry has been acutely aware of this, you know, even as it's been heaping in more and more salt, sugar, and fat. And the other stunning thing, too, and I think this is another reason why they agreed to open up to me, is that they themselves are hooked on these three ingredients. They're the holy grail for the processed food industry, for providing convenience, they act as preservatives, for providing, you know, for enabling their foods to be incredibly low cost because they're so cheap, especially salt, and for providing this sort of utter irresistible taste that keeps their sales up and keeps Wall Street happy.
Right. You know, it's interesting you use the word enablers. And that was sort of the sense I got while reading the book, is that these guys are really, you know, these big food giants are just as hooked on salt, sugar, and fat as consumers are. And, you know, it's a huge industry. You know, it's what, $1 trillion a year, 16 million jobs in the United States. You know, can they shift? Can they pivot, remain profitable, and do, you know, what is right by consumers?
That's a really good question. I went to them to talk about salt, for example. I went out to Battle Creek, Michigan, to Kellogg's research and development facility. They gave me a tour. Then we sat down. And 8 versions of their icons that have been specially prepared for me without any salt. They wanted to impress upon me just how difficult it was for them to cut back on salt in their products. We started with Cheez-Its. Normally, I could eat those day in, day out. They stuck to the roof of our mouths. We couldn't even swallow them because the salt provides texture and solubility. We moved to the frozen waffles, popped them in the toaster. They came out looking and tasting like straw. The most amazing one was the cornflakes. We put them in a bowl with milk, tasted. And before I could say anything, I'm looking at the spokeswoman for the company. She gets this look of horror on her face and blurts out, "Metal." M-E-T-A-L. I taste metal. And the chief scientist who is with us says, "Yeah, not everybody tastes that, but many people do it. You know, it's a result of some of the, you know, the food processing technology and the additives that we use, whether it's vitamins or otherwise. And salt acts as a masking agent. So, you know, it especially is a miracle ingredient for the ingredient and for the industry. And I think one of the key questions here is, and they keep trying to dial back, and they keep offering foods that have less this, less that. And I was meeting with a legend in the industry, a food consultant who's worked on many icons, and he was pointing out to me, this was just recently, that I mean, really, they need to rethink their products from the ground up if they really want to make them truly healthy and palatable. It's not just, you know, they can't just dial back on salt or sugar or fat or sometimes all three and then fiddle with the rest of the ingredients and hope to have a solution. They've really got to do some substantial, solid research. And they have the power to do that.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you talk about, you know, that attempt to sort of dial back on some of these ingredients to, you know, address the obesity issue head on. And one of the examples is Campbell's soup.
Yes.
And they dialed back on the salt, and then Wall Street came back and said, "Well, that's great, but you're losing money. So let's go ahead and put that salt back in." So, you know, how beholden are these big companies to Wall Street, and how does that sort of counterintuitive to their attempts to kind of do right by consumers?
No, absolutely. They're totally beholden. And, you know, one of my favorite nutrition policy experts, Mary Nessel, points to the early 80s in Silicon Valley as being one of the prime movers here. Wall Street became, you know, enamored by the profits they were making off of tech stocks and came to expect those on everything, went to blue chip companies, including the food industry, which was never, you know, a huge, huge moneymaker for Wall Street. They were just sort of steady plodding along. And increasingly you saw, and people inside the companies told me that, you know, where they used to pay attention to Wall Street once a year, you know, it became once a quarter, then once a month, once a week, and daily. And some of these companies began putting up, you know, tickers of their stock price in the lobby of their companies to impress upon the employees just, you know, where their priority lay. It wasn't in nutrition. It wasn't in the consumers necessarily. It was to the stock price. That's how beholden they are, at least at the top. But then you have these cobbles of insiders who really do care about consumers and care about nutrition, care about doing the right thing. And I think in any number of these companies, these people at various times, you know, become empowered and try to do the right thing. It happened at Kraft. I write about that in the book. Mm-hmm. And again, the issue is when they do it unilaterally, they'll get beaten back, not just by Wall Street, but by their competitors who are always angling for more room on the grocery shelf.
Right. It's interesting because you speak about Kraft and, you know, Philip Morris, you know, the tobacco giant now owns Kraft and General Mills. And what I found interesting is that Philip Morris sort of had this insight. They were like, we've been through this, guys. This is going to come back and haunt you. We should really start, you know, addressing this head on. What, right. You know, can you talk a little bit about sort of that relationship between the Philip Morris executives?
Yeah, I was so surprised by that. In fact, so the documents that I came across, in fact, are courtesy of Philip Morris when the state attorneys general sued Big Tobacco and won a settlement. One of the agreements of the settlement is that they were allowed to extract, you know, millions and millions of pages of internal records from the tobacco industry. And when I went into that archive, just by chance, I discovered there was a trove of food-related documents in there as well, because Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company in North America, became the largest food manufacturer in North America when it acquired General Foods first and then Kraft in the 1980s. And through the 80s and 90s, you can see through these records and my interviews with officials, including the former CEO, Philip Morris, you know, the tobacco executives doing what you would expect, you know, pushing the food division people to make more money by selling more product. They even lent some of their marketing skills and tools to the food division people, especially when it came to marketing to corners, stores, which is huge, especially for the snack food industry. And then starting in the early 2000s, there was an about face. Philip Morris became the first tobacco company to embrace government regulation. They were worried about losing the entire trust of their consumers. And when they did that, they turned to their food division and said, you guys are going to face as greater, greater problems over salt, sugar, fat, obesity, as we are now on, you know, with nicotine and cigarettes. And you need to start doing something to reduce your dependence on these three. It was a remarkable and such a surprising moment.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, I like to talk about sort of the marketing aspect of this whole game, because just as in later we'll talk about the science and engineering, because that's just incredibly fascinating, but just as important is this marketing push. And I remember, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and so I remember when Lunchables came out, and I remember being sort of envious of the kids who had Lunchables, because my mom was a little bit more of, you know, a Betty Homemaker, and, you know, I had my brown bag lunch, and I remember thinking, God, I want a Lunchable. I want to have that, until I actually tasted it. And then I was like, I don't ever want to have that again.
So Lunchables was conceived by marketing geniuses at Oscar Mayer, the meat company, which was getting into some trouble in the 80s. People were eating less red meat because of saturated fat and salt. And so they went to their marketing people and said, well, can you help us out here? They looked at the basic product, bologna, and they said, well, let's try to repackage it. They spent a couple of years actually doing incredible work in trying to figure out what would appeal to people. They came up with this dinner, you know, this TV dinner-like tray in which they put, you know, little pieces of bologna, then they added cheese and crackers because they couldn't use bread because it wouldn't last on the shelf for the months that they needed to. They tried to add fresh carrots and thought about apples, and those wouldn't last either. Again, you know, ultra-processed foods are just inherently sort of anti-fresh fruit and vegetable. And they began selling them, and very early on they realized that the appeal of the Lunchables wasn't about the food. It was about the empowerment, especially when it came to kids. And they came up with the slogan, all day you got to do it they say, but lunchtime is all yours. Right. Kids went crazy for the Lunchables because, A, it looked really cool, and B, they could assemble the little pieces of food themselves and any which way they wanted. And thereafter, you know, then it was turned into the pizza Lunchables and the hamburger and the hot dog and the pancake Lunchables, all cold.
Right, all cold. Yeah.
And all like, you know, to their mothers, they were like disgusting, but the kids went crazy for them. And the other important thing about the Lunchables is that, you know, it became a gateway product for bringing fast food into the grocery store. Other companies mimicked the Lunchables, and that was a really huge development because I think, you know, for so long and even today, we have an inherent trust in the grocery store. We think that when we walk through the door, we're going to get food basically that's good for us. And some of that has changed now, especially as grocery manufacturers have tried to compete with fast food chains through items like the Lunchables.
Right. You know, to get to that point where they really understand their market, and you talked about kids and marketing to kids and, you know, moms looking at Lunchables and saying, that's disgusting, but the kids are clamoring for it, and you know, they, I want it. You know, that was a fascinating part to me is that, you know, the amount of dollars and effort that goes into the research, and the, you know, talk about the Monell Institute, which is largely funded by these food giants. Can you talk about sort of these, you know, research that they're doing to really target in on these demographics?
Yeah, I mean, Monell is doing pure research into the basic senses and the basic appeal of salt, sugar, fat. To their credit, they have done some of the most, you know, what the industry might find disconcerting research. I mean, they have found, for example, recently that we're not born liking salt. Our taste for salt actually doesn't develop until we're about 6 months of age. And the processed food industry is hugely influential on that. Kids that are exposed more to processed foods are much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in preschool. So the Monell, while they take funding from the industry, is amazingly independent, yet the industry uses their research. And they also have on staff just, you know, some of the brightest food scientists out there, all working diligently, you know, in the pure science mode, but also look, the end product is everybody's working toward, you know, getting a product that has the most utter appeal. The industry hates the word addiction, and it rightfully argues that there are some threshold definitions of addiction that apply to narcotic addiction that don't apply to food. They prefer words like snackable, allure, moorishness. But the goal
like
is the same.
One.
You know, the driving force is not to get people just to like their products. It's to get people to want more and more.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about the science behind these foods. I mean, this isn't just cooking food. We're engineering food.
Yes, and that's the term that one of the legends in the industry, Howard Moskowitz, uses to describe his work. He's developed some of the biggest icons for some of the biggest companies, who's trained in experimental psychology at Harvard and was a mathematician out of Queens College. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper. And to get at a version that was guaranteed to be a hit for the company, he started with 61 different variations of flavors, sweetness, each just slightly different than the other, subjected those to some 3,000 taste tests, and then took the data and threw it into his computer to do his high math regression analysis thing. And out came the most perfect level of sweetness, which he calls and helped coin the phrase the bliss point. Any of your listeners who like, say, you know, sweet coffee can do the same experiment. You take coffee and you keep adding sugar until you get to the perfect amount for your taste. You keep adding more, and eventually you get to the yuck place where you go, oh, this is way too sweet. So we don't have an infinite liking for sugar. And in fact, it's sort of a bell-shaped curve where the optimum amount of sweetness is right at the top of the bell curve. And so scientists like him have created, engineered bliss point formulas, rather, for foods all over the grocery store now to hit the bliss point, whether it's bread, pasta sauce, yogurts. You know, that's the goal, which is to make the most utterly attractive, and it's called optimization also in all of the products.
Right, and then they sort of use that science, and I kind of have this sense that it's like, you know, the science has fallen into the wrong hands. Good science has fallen into the wrong hands. But they use this science to market the products, and you talked about, you know, mini wheats as brain food in the book, and and you know, it's scientifically proven to make you happy. You know,
yeah, and then the marketing. So then the marketers take over. And I mean, I have to say, I loved sitting down with these scientists, and especially because so many of them now have regret over what they did. And they can argue to their defense that, look, many of these products they invented were invented back in a more innocent era when our dependence on them was not as deep as it was now. They intended them perhaps more as a treat, not as an hourly thing to consume. And starting in the 80s, it was almost overnight that it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime, and that played right into the hands of the processed food industry, the snack food. So, yeah, to some extent, but yes, when their pure science then is taken over by the marketing people, then you really see some doozies. And as you mentioned, Kellogg recently had a marketing campaign where it tried to argue that its mini wheats would make kids more attentive in the classroom. Unfortunately, their own studies didn't quite back up the numbers that they were using, and then the Federal Trade Commission forced them to pull back on the advertising claims. But again, it sort of speaks to the fierce competition among these companies for space on the grocery shelf.
Right. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back here with Michael Moss, author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, on heritageradionetwork.org.
You are listening to Numb by Tacstar on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cane5.com.
All right, welcome back. I'm Eddie Schumard, and you're listening to a special community session on heritageradionetwork.org. Today I'm talking with Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Before the break, you sort of touched on regulation a little bit. Does the industry need to be regulated by government? You know,
I mean, I was sort of surprised by how the food industry in many ways is far more powerful than the government agencies that supposedly, you know, are supposed to regulate it on behalf of consumers. And you know, take cheese, for example. The government has incentivized the industry to make so much cheese, it piles up. And when it piled up, the government then created a scheme that allows their industry to raise tens of millions of dollars every year for marketing schemes that encourage us to eat more cheese. And this is not just cheese as an appetizer before a meal to be eaten by itself. This is cheese also that's used as an additive, both in home cooking and in processed foods. Excuse me, you go to the dairy aisle now and it's bulging with bags of shredded cubes, you know, diced, string, tubbed cheese, all to get you to eat and use it more in foods. And that's an issue because cheese is now the number one source of saturated fat in our diet. Our cheese consumption has tripled to an average of 33 pounds since the 70s. And it sort of speaks to sort of the mindlessness of food. The less we pay attention to the food we're eating, and including the ingredients in the food, the more apt we are to cut the brain out of the equation and eliminate kind of the natural breaks we have to keep us from overeating. So regulation, I mean, I'm empathetic with people who don't want Mayor Bloomberg of New York, you know, putting a cap on soda sizes. But I think we all have to realize that the playing field is not level.
Right.
Obesity is costing an estimated $300 billion in added medical expenses and lost productivity. And the soda industry is in there spending tons of money to get us to drink more. So when you walk into a grocery store, or even worse, kids who walk into convenience stores, you know, they are not in control of the situation, as people who accuse Mayor Bloomberg of the nanny state might think.
Right. And that's something that I think maybe, you know, empowering consumers might be more productive than, say, punishing consumers or telling them what to do, you know. And we talked about, you know, the funding and the research and all this power that these corporations have in terms of controlling this industry. How can real food compete with that? You know, how can sustainable regional food sheds compete with this kind of might?
So one of the things that we've sort of done in our own family, and I'm hoping that the book is an eye opener in that sense, is just kind of knowing everything that the companies throw at you is empowering in a way. And so when you walk in the door of the grocery store, they try to do everything they can to get you to make a spontaneous decision. That's why sometimes you'll see soda coolers at the checkout counter, within reach. And so make a list and stick to it. You know, work the outer margins, the outer aisles of the grocery store. That's where the fresh fruits and vegetables are, which everybody says we should be eating more of. When you get to the middle of the store, you know, the most loaded products are at eye level. They're placed there strategically. So if you're looking for cereal, for example, with lesser amounts of sugar, you're going to want to look low, reach high. And in terms of economically, too, I mean, I happen to know that one of the things the White House is now looking at is not, you know, not necessarily sort of taxes on the worse for you stuff, but shifting the existing huge subsidies that are on processed foods over to the better foods, the fresh fruits and vegetables, as a way of leveling the playing field economically, so that when we walk in and want to do the right thing by ourselves and our families, we don't have to pay such a higher price for those foods, which we do now.
Right, and you sort of touch on that a little bit in the book when you go to Strawberry Mansion, the community, where the residents sort of took it upon themselves to say, we want to take back, you know, the control over what our kids are eating before they go to school. And talk a little bit about sort of the deception in labeling and the lack of maybe transparency or just you know, ignorance on consumer side about what does a package really, what is it really telling me?
Yeah, that was so inspiring. This is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Philadelphia. It used to be one of the more violent ones. A school principal came in and tried to, you know, raise the academic standards in a public elementary school. She found that kids were coming into school in the morning strung out on junk food they were buying at these corner stores that strategically ring the school there and in other cities around the country. She went to the bodegas and tried to get them not to sell the kids in the morning. They refused. She got the parents to organize themselves to do an intervention. They were taught by groups that used to teach them to fight crack houses. They stood outside the corner stores and tried to deflect their kids from going in there in the morning, because just for like a dollar, the kids could run in and run out with 350 empty sugary calories that would just ruin their attention span in classrooms. And one of the most telling moments, though, is when I was standing there with a man, and his wife came along with her kids, and it was a harried morning, and she didn't have time to get them breakfast. She ran into the store and came out with these breakfast bars, and she was so pleased because on the front of the bar, the manufacturer was touting the added calcium. And You know, this is one of the huge issues in the store, and another thing that we can do too, and I like to do now, which is to, we all know to look at the fine print and the ingredients, but I like to start with the front of the package, because that's where you'll find products that say, like, low fat, but they're loaded with sugar, or low sugar, but they're loaded with fat. Yogurt is a classic one. In this case, you know, the granola bar added calcium. We flipped it over, looked at the fine print, and it had as much sugar and fat in it as a pack of cookies. And so, you know, it really does come down to education as well. We have lost our home economic program in this country that used to teach girls and boys about shopping and eating and cooking. And it's incumbent upon us to relearn those tools if we are going to level the playing field for ourselves and our kids.
Right. And, you know, and as the food movement grows and the conversation matures a bit, and there's this real push for eating real foods and home-cooked meals, is there a way for, you know, advocates, real food advocates and you know, slow food folks to kind of use the same methods to push fresh produce and, you know, fresh vegetables like these, you know, these food giants have?
You know, I think there is. I mean, one of my favorite persons I met in all this reporting was the former president for North America, South America of Coca-Cola, Jeffrey Dunn. He was one of their fiercest warriors for 20 years. He walked me through their targeting of kids, their pioneering of the supersize me phenomena. They're calling their best customers heavy users, people who drink 3 cans of Coke or more a day. And I caught up with him. He's now selling fresh baby carrots, having taken a page from the playbook of the snack food industry. He's convinced that if we can market healthy foods with the same pizzazz and genius that junk foods are marketed, they'll be far more appealing, and it makes so much sense to me. That and also just engaging kids. You can't just throw sliced carrots or baby carrots and fresh apples at kids and expect to eat them in the lunchroom when you're not there watching if you don't engage them in the conversation. And I think a combination of those two things, absolutely.
Right. And, you know, it's being there as well. And maybe, you know, I there's such a powerful media message. You know, when Dora the Explorer or, you know, these popular kind of cartoon mm-hmm. characters are pushing these products, mm-hmm. it's difficult for, you know, the kids to say, well, Dora likes Cheetos. Why can't I have Cheetos? You know, so,
you know, again, in some of the stronger consumer advocacy groups like the Center for Science and the Public Interest have been fighting for years to get the Federal Trade Commission to force the industry to cut back on its marketing to kids. And I mentioned to you Kraft. Kraft actually came up with an anti-obesity initiative in 2003, and the first thing they looked at and the first improvement they made to their policies was to cut back on marketing to children of the most sugary foods, because children can't tell the difference, young ones especially, between advertising and reality. It's a real problem. It's a persistent one, and it's going to take a lot louder voices from consumers to make it happen, because regulators, you know, elected officials are risk-averse. They're not going to do anything unless they're forced to.
Right. You know, so you've kind of talked a little bit about Kraft. You know, who out there in the industry or formerly from the industry, who's out there changing the game right now? You know, I like to catch people, you know, doing it right. Like, you know, who's out there kind of really trying to change this momentum? Who's shifting the paradigm here?
You know, I think all of these companies are trying somewhat. I love the story of Kraft, and I go into it in detail in the book. It's so informative. You know, how successful they've been more recently is open to question, again, because of competition from other companies and pushback from Wall Street. You know, Campbell Soup, we mentioned, I think that's a terrific company in so many ways, and they really are trying to cut back on salt in their soups, and again, under pressure from Wall Street. We're at a real tipping point right now, and I really think in the next year or two, and I'm going to be writing about this, that you're going to start seeing some companies doing innovative things to really alter in a meaningful ways the health profile of their products. I have to say, before we talked, I noticed one of your sponsors was Route 11 potato chips. Mm-hmm. And I by chance came across them in my travels, and we went to their factory. I mean, they have a lower sodium potato chip that is just marvelous. I have to say, if you're worried about sodium, that is such
That's a great product.
Now, you're still going to have the same issue that it has fat, it has calories. You're going to have to find ways to control it. But, you know, this book is not about avoiding even all junk foods or processed foods. It's about understanding them and finding ways to have control over them rather than letting them have control over you. But I think it's smaller companies like that will help pioneer the way forward here.
So I think this is a great place to sort of wrap it up, is that, you know, empowering consumers. But I want you to maybe give us a little insight. What can we do to help kind of push us over that tipping point? What can consumers do to reach out to these industries and incentivize, you know, better behavior?
Look, I don't want to be self-serving, but I, you know, I have to say, you know, read this book.
Right.
Send it, you know, give it to your friends. It will enlighten you in ways that you just can't imagine. It will take you inside these companies. You will understand how they operate. And then if you care, raise your voice. Be loud. Write letters. You know, contact consumer advocates who are working on these issues. You know, become strident. I mean, because that is what it's going to take to overcome, you know, the opposite forces.
Right. Well, that's all the time we have today. Michael, thank you so much for being on today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've been talking to Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. You can always find archived episodes on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. heritageradionetwork.org, member supported.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.